like to thank the organizers, but I don't see the chief organizer for giving me the opportunity to talk to you. And so what I'd like to show you is actually lots of movies and data and some particle imaging of the symmetry, and to discuss a little bit some of the significances of that. We have, so I'm giving the talk, so that's why I'm in capital letters, but Luis and Chris are both graduate students, as is Martin Short. They're wonderful students. Sujoy is a terrific undergraduate who's taking most of the pictures of the robots, as you'll see. Ray Goldstein is very famous, and he's my chief colleague. And Chris Solari is a biologist who brought the Volvox project to us. He graduated, he's a businessman in Buenos Aires, and he does biology and algophysiology on the side, and does it very, very well indeed. So anyway, so that's the situation. And Ricardo Cortez is in red because he has not been in Arizona. He's at Tulane. He's done a lot of the beautiful calculations, which I will show you in a bit. So I thought I'd first show you the dramatis personae and then go on from there. This is a Bacillus subtilis. This is an electron transmission electron microscope picture. This length here is on the order of, depending on the particular cell or the particular nutrition, but it's of the order of 4, 5, 6 microns. This particular one is dividing here. They elongate and then they divide, and so there are some long cells always in the culture and some short ones. The flagella, which you see here, shadowed here in the electron microscope picture, they come out every which way. It's called peritrichously flagellated, which Lighthill would have liked as a name. That means that the flagella come out everywhere. They form a but when they swim, they all turn in the same direction. There are motors in the bacterial cell wall. The flagella are helical, as you can you can see them as sinusoids, but actually in 3Ds they're helical, and they rotate, and they may form a bundle, and this whole thing swims along at a great rate. The rotation velocity of the flagella tends to be of the order of, maybe 100 per second for these kinds of cells. They can go up to couple of thousand per second for certain kinds of bacteria. So they go at a really tremendous rate. So here's some more pictures of these bacteria done in different kinds of ways. This is, I work mostly with Bacillus subtilis. E. coli, one of our students, Chris Dombrowski, works mostly with E. coli. And these are actually live cells in the flagella, are only 20 nanometers in diameter. Flagella bundle is a little bit bigger, but this is actually swimming cells seen in the differential interference microscope. And what he does is he manages to attach beads or work with the flagella, with the bacteria themselves, puts them in optical tweezers, and you can have fluid flowing by and study the dynamics in the optical tweezer. This is Bacillus subtilis, again in the dead state. This is an atomic force microscope. Here you can see the divisions where they're about to divide very nicely. This is a transmission electron microscope for the E. coli, rather larger magnification than this here. And you see the E. coli in a slightly different shape. And this is fluorescent microscopy of live E. coli. So the first thing that I'm going to talk about, and then not talk about bacteria again for a while, is the volvocales, in particular Volvox. The volvocales are a group of algae. That means that they're eukaryotes. They live from sunlight and small molecules, which are in the medium. Small molecules are, in particular, carbon dioxide when they photosynthesize, oxygen when they respire, and various kinds of things like phosphates and nitrates and so on and so forth. The smallest one is called Planomonas, a very famous cell. It has two flagella and it swims. Then they have various sizes until these have undifferentiated colonies. When they get sufficiently large, they produce a matrix of a gel-like material, and on this matrix are small cells called somatic cells. I call them in a future slide, you'll see I'll call them galley slaves, because all they do is row and photosynthesize. I mean, they're really slaves to the daughter cells, to the germ cells, which become daughter colonies, and which grow and grow, and eventually are let go. So we're studying the swimming of that. And the question is, why do they swim? And they swim perhaps to get somewhere sometimes, but very often we have proven, we think, that they swim mostly in order to improve transport of metabolites, of cells, of small molecules into and out of the organism. So to go from a newly hatched daughter cell to a daughter colony to a mother colony, which starts all over again, is about 2 days. Yes?
Does the daughter cell have the same flagella?
Yes. Yes. In fact,
they swim within the matrix themselves?
They generally do not swim within the matrix. That is, they don't move around. But if you look carefully in the microscope, what they do is they have flagella and they do this kind of stuff. And they're trying to get out. It's like a baby trying to get out. You know? So, and in fact, eventually they do get out. What we've been doing is looking at various, and I'm not going to go in great length through this, through the data, because we have two publications, both in PNAS. One is this one here, which was already published, and another one which is in the works, which has been accepted, where we have deflagellated the cells, and we have looked at deflagellation with stirring and without stirring, and in fact we've proven that the motion of the flagella, the motion of the fluid, which is moved by the flagella, is important for the nutrition of the cells. And I'll talk about that in a minute in terms of Peclet numbers and so on. At any rate, so you start out with one cell, with a unicellular alga, and then eventually you get very large ones, which can have as many as sort of 5, even 10, up to 10,000 cells in one colony. And the question is, what's in it for them? And it's a system for looking at evolution of multicellularity and cell differentiation. Maybe I'm going to plug that along. I'll never get that. So this is a single one. These are the somatic cells, or the galley slaves, and called galley slaves. These white ones out here, they're particularly white, it's just imaged that way because of the vague areas of the focusing. These are the daughter colonies, developing daughter colonies. And if you, see is that the flagella move the fluid around, and these small, in this case, dirt particles, mostly dirt particles, show you what the flow field looks like. We can look again, but now this time with fluorescent microspheres, fluorescent passive markers. This is the flow field around the colony. And if we then continue and look at higher magnification, we can see there are some fluorescent markers stuck here, and you can see the flagella going around, and some flagella go like that. And you'll see them in more detail in a minute.
Is the whole cell moving?
This particular, the colony is stuck, and we can look at it while moving, but what we're really doing most of is we look at stuck colonies, and the way we do that is we have a micropipette, and let's say if my head is like this, like a cell colony, a Volvox colony. You put the pipette next to the head, and then you go suck a little bit, and it can't get away, and then so it's passive. So it's like a lollipop on a stick, and then we can look at the flow fields around it.
The super glue commercial.
Beg your pardon?
The super glue, remember the super glue commercial where they glued guys to the
end? Oh, I don't know that. I do know that the guys in Cambridge do that with butterflies and dragonflies and stuff, so this is a bit less cruel.
What are the velocities that you're measuring?
The velocities tend to be of the order of hundreds of microns.
And then this whole structure is how big?
The whole structure is, on the, depending on the particular organism, the smallest one, the single cells, are of the order of 10 microns to 10 to 12 microns in diameter. These big guys are up to half a millimeter or three quarters of a millimeter in diameter, so they're easy to see with naked eye. Yeah. And the in-between ones of 16 cells, 64 cells, and so on, Yeah, go ahead. Just a second. Yeah.
Oh, do you think of this as a fully enclosed shell? Are there pores and this fluid get in and out of the inside?
As far as we can tell, but this is something that we want to look at for various reasons, as far as we can tell, there's no throughput of the fluid. The shell inside is something called the extracellular, the ECM, the extracellular matrix, and the rowing cells, the ones on the outside, the somatic cells, are stuck in it, and they synthesize. Obviously, they photosynthesize. They have synthesized material for it, and there's something called the storage hypothesis that is used for storage. So it's used both geometrically and for storage. And to get from the surface to the daughter cells, eventually the daughter colonies, it looks like you have to diffuse, but we don't know that for sure. It may be that there are some channels and there may be some flow. But as far as we know, there is no direct outside flow to the inside. There may be some other flows. When you look at, somebody back there asked me about the daughter colonies flagella. When you look at the daughter colonies inside one of these things, as I said, they do this, which means that they have a fluid sheath around them. I think he would want to ask a question.
I was just going to ask, do you have the observation, the daughter cell always close to the surface of the colony?
No, it's not. The daughter cell is not close to the surface of the colony. And one of my historical interests has been in the sensing or the passive sensing of gravity. And what happens is that the daughter colonies are all at the posterior end of the cell, so the cells. I mean, of the colonies. So the colonies float in such a way that the daughter colonies are below and it swims up towards the sun. But they're distributed within the extracellular matrix, the ECM, but not near the surface. Yes?
Just a clarification. If this wasn't stuck down,
no.
It would be moving around because of
that's
the
correct.
Flagella. Is
that's
there
correct.
Any coordination of that flagella motion?
Indeed.
To get to go one way.
Indeed.
There's a network.
Indeed, there are several kinds of coordinates. No, there's not a network. We don't. This is one thing that we really want. We're looking at. There's not a network. It's been shown that there's not a network. Some cells, some of these colonies have cytoplasmic bridges between the somatic cells. Cytoplasmic bridges are apparently passive, and the way the flagella work are different on the various portions of the cell. So here they might be doing this, and at the bottom they might be doing that. But there are enough coordinated, so each somatic cell has photosensors, so they're not coordinated, so they don't think and swim towards the light, which is very interesting. We don't know very much about that yet. But we're looking mostly now at the transport rather than the, how shall I say, we're getting some kids.
Yeah, there's a guy at Duke that is looking at gene networks in bacterial columns.
Okay, well, we'll get to that.
I'm
giving two talks. One is in the Volvox and one is in the bacteria. Okay?
Right.
So, what did I want to say? I wanted to say something else in the Volvox, but I forgot. Anyway, so let's show some more. So, I'm going to higher and higher magnification. So, why do you stop? So, there are a couple of luminescent thingies stuck on these flagella. And now you can begin to see that not only do you get these remote flows, but you also get chaotic flows around. What you really have is the classical version of the blinking Stokes slits, and you'll see a little bit more of that. I'll get to higher magnification. Oops. So here, if you look at this carefully, you see there's a lot of wiggly. I mean, the field isn't really smooth. And what you'll see in a minute is that the flagella, maybe here. So these are two bright field pictures. This is done with a high-speed camera. The flagella go at a fairly good clip, let's say more than about 30 times a second or something like that. So if you look at this, can you pick it up? There's a little light walking. Yeah. Now it's very interesting because this kind of motion produces chaotic transport locally, but far away it gets smoothed out and produces beautiful far field smooth trajectories. So let's look at the other one. Come on. So this is not real time.
This
is. Yes.
Are these always kind of paired up, the flagella, it looks like?
Yes. The Clavinomonas, the primitivest, the most primitive cell in the series, has two flagella, and the way it swims, because it's low Reynolds number, you know, if you swim like that, you can't do it. It swims like that. So going up is less, and going down is bigger. So swims like that. So these somatic cells are very similar to Clavinomonas. They can't, when the colony breaks apart, they sometimes swim around in the liquid for a couple of hours, but they're not viable and they don't reproduce. But they do have the two flagella from left over from before, so to say. So this is now, you can see the ball box on the stick. This is now a flow field from which Sujar took just a few days ago. And you see, depending on which direction you've got this thing, you either get these beautiful vortex-producing fields. This dot, 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 this is because the camera is at approximately 12 frames per second, so that you can measure the risk of the velocity that way. You can, of course, measure with PIV, which is what we do.
Is there any large-scale flow in this? Or are you confident?
This is a large-scale flow.
I mean, if you killed the cell, is there any flow?
Oh, there's nothing, no.
You're confident of that?
Yeah, there's nothing. Yes?
How much of this is due to wall effect?
The shape of the flow can be due to wall effects. And I will show the prettiest picture of all was next to the wall. But this particular one was not. The walls were very far away. So we're not unaware of the possibility of wall effects, is the answer, yeah.
So another thing that's striking about this is if you look at the tracers sort of in the vortex area,
yeah.
I don't know if it's not really vortex, but they're actually wiggly.
Well, I thought that they were wiggly because of this. Okay.
Which would seem impossible.
Which would seem impossible.
What would cause it?
But Sujai said that people were walking in the hall and the table was wiggling.
Yeah,
okay. So here's one with fewer wiggles. Okay, so these are nice trick pictures. But if you look carefully, there's still lots of wiggles. And I'm not convinced that I should say it in a positive way. I do believe that some of the wiggles are due to the fact of that the drive is a reciprocal drive, but not all, but one would have to look at that very carefully, which we have not done. But we have looked how far the field goes and how fast the.
What's the frequency of the? It's hundreds of 100 per second or so.
No, that the bacterial rotation rate, the bacterial flagella rotation rate, is on the order of 100 per second for something like E. coli or Bacillus subtilis. The rotation rate for some bacteria is much higher, and for these guys, this rate is on the order of 20 to 30 times per second.
20 to 30
hertz. Yes. So when you look at it on just an ordinary video camera, you can see it's going on. It's just not very good.
Okay.
So this picture, which Ray Goldstein took with a solar eclipse kind of a thing in the middle, so to make it worthwhile, you can see these gorgeous chaotic recycling regions around. Locally and from far away, you don't necessarily have it, but this picture was fairly close to a wall, so I'm just not quite sure what about the wall effects. I'll get, when I talk about the bacteria, I'll get into the situation talking about what sort of flows you get from a self-propelled object, which is very different from the kind of flow that you get from an object that's moved by the Deus Ex Machina, like gravity field or something like that, which is pulled far away. So what we've done is we've shown theoretically, and this is published, you can look up on it, I'm not going to put equations up, is the metabolic demand is something goes like approximately R squared. That doesn't take into account the metabolic demand from the daughter colonies, but on the other hand, everything has to go through the surface, and you can argue that approximately parabolic curve is approximately the demand, and we are in the process of actually measuring the metabolic demand and metabolism rates with appropriate people in the chemistry department, biochemistry. Anyway, so that's the demand. This is the rate at which diffusion can supply stuff to a passive sphere. And this you can read about this in Howard Berg's book, but you can calculate it, it's very easy. So you see that there's a radius at which diffusion simply can't keep up with the thing anymore. And so that radius, okay, so that radius, we'll just remember that for a second. If you have active transport, and because of the fact that you're moving the fluid, then the advective contribution, it goes like this, like the green line, and you see you get rid of this, what we call for a while the diffusive bottleneck. So, and it happens that this radius, which you can calculate, is approximately the size at which you get cell differentiation. So you get the differentiation between having all cells totipotent, being both reproductive and flagellated cells, and having cells which are only somatic and not reproductive cells.
Why is the metabolic demand proportional to surface area and not volume?
Because the volume is mostly empty. But I agree with you. This is a good question. I don't think it's quite right, but it's also not very wrong. Okay. So it's a pair of something like that. Oops, no, that's not right. What we've done. This is Martin Short, who is incidentally looking for a postdoc position. He did a very nice calculation of. Saying if you have, instead of the boundary condition at the fluid at the solid interface between fluid and algal body, if you have instead a shear stress boundary condition, then you have flow at the surface. This is the flow which is driven by the flagella, which are very close to the surface, and then you can compute what the flow profile should actually look at. So we computed this red line, and this stuff, these things with the error bars, are actually found with PIE, so that was pretty nice.
What is that boundary condition?
normally, if you have an object and you have fluid flowing by, the boundary, the normal boundary condition is that there's no slip and there's no motion at the boundary. But if the boundary is pushing, at the boundary, let's say this is the boundary, it's pushing fluid, then at the boundary, which is now defined slightly off the real boundary, you have a net stress that pushes the fluid. Stress within the area. That was actually started by Tim Padley and his associates. You get a flow, which is a flow that's driven around from the boundary. Okay? So, for those of you who don't know about Peckler numbers, this is the advection diffusion equation, and if you make the ratio of the transport of advection, transport of diffusion, this ratio is a diffusion time divided by a velocity-driven transport time. And if that's a big ratio, namely if the diffusion line is diffusion time is long, if the Peckler number is large, then the thing is convection or velocity dominated. And in the case of the reason why this is written like that is because I lost my thing on my equation writer on the PowerPoint, and then I just wrote it like that. at any rate, so it turns out that for the bacteria, the Peckler number, individual bacteria, the Peckler number is small. For Clamis monas, the Peckler number is very small, but for something like Volvox, which are half a millimeter and which drive the fluid at a very good clip, like a couple of hundred or up to 500 microns per second. And for even small molecules, the Peckler number is rather large. If you look at larger molecules, like in the case of the bacteria, you might want to have extra polysaccharides, some stuff that they produce, it's going to be a different kind of thing. But this is for oxygen, where the diffusion coefficient, or CO2, is about something 2 times 10 to the minus 5 centimeters squared per second. Another interesting thing, so there's two papers in America, two papers in PNAS, and one is going to be out, I think, this month, perhaps in May, in American Naturalist, with Christian Solari as the first author. One of the really interesting things is that you can compute, depending on what the Peckler number is, you can compute what the profile, what the concentration profile of something that's being taken up is. And if there's enough flow, you get this long plume. And these plumes are really quite interesting from the point of view of objects, biological objects communicating with one another, or getting out of each other's way, or whatever. So the papers that we wrote are mostly written in terms of uptake of nutrients, but I think that if you don't like that, and if you worry about what is actually limiting nutrients and stuff like that, you can think of the fact that they've got to get rid of stuff, so that if it's photosynthesizing, they've got to get rid of oxygen, and the whole story really goes very nicely with that also. You can get rid of oxygen and not have an oxygen, inhibiting oxygen shell, which would stop the photosynthesis.
Can I this, when you do these calculations, so if I understood you right, basically you're imposing a constant stress boundary condition?
That's correct.
So doesn't that mean that actually that you have a net force on the whole body?
In this situation, the body is held in this particular picture, the body is held by the pipette. But when the body swims, then that force is compensated by a drag force, and you get something rather similar, but it's not exactly the same, because you have to superimpose it yourself. And by the way, the Reynolds number for the Volvox is not large, but it's not as small as for bacteria, so it's on the order of, let's say, 0.1 to 1, something like that. Okay. I'm done for the time being with Volvox, unless somebody asks me later. So I think I've managed half an hour. Yeah.
The Peckler number, the velocity that you use is the external
is a flow field, yes.
Wouldn't it be important to have calculated the packet number of the velocity that's inside the cell?
Inside?
Yeah.
Inside is zero.
So inside of the column.
Inside of the column is zero.
Just rely on diffusions.
Yes. Yes. And look, I said yes because I don't know any better. But I don't really believe that. And I think that there might very well be some channels where something could be going on. And one of the things we have in the works is to inject some stuff that we might be able to follow that. But we have not done it. And meanwhile, the answer has to be here. Diffusion of the
okay? Just clear up one thing. What do you think the action of the flagella is? Is it the rotation at the base, or how does it
it's a bending motion.
But how does it get that from without anything down here that's causing bending?
It's like a cilium, and you have sliding filaments inside it.
So there is like muscle action within
the flagella. It's a typical eukaryotic flagella.
Okay.
Okay. Lamellar filament. But anyway, so his question, we had an answer to do with the fact that bacterial flagella are strands of polymer strands of some complexity, whereas these things actually are much more complex. They're much wider. The flagella of algae are on the order of micron in diameter, whereas the ones of bacteria are 20 nanometers, and it's just a different kind of.
Yes, there's not a passive material.
That's right. So if something slides in it, it goes like that. Okay, now I want to get to the to something which may be even more queer than you have seen, and that is what happens with bacteria. Now, the bacteria that I work with, by the way, I've not had training in bacteriology or in safe handling of bacteria, but as you see, I am alive. and so these are harmless bacteria, unless you happen to do some really stupid things with them, like stick it in your eye or and other possible risks. Anyway, so what happens is that the swimming of individual bacteria is very interesting from the point of view of biology, and also it's interesting from the point of view of fluid dynamics. And the swimming of several bacteria, it gets even more interesting. And when the thing gets, when the population becomes so concentrated, becomes close packed, it's absolutely amazing what's happened. So I'm going to start, in order to keep you awake, I'm going to start with the amazing end, rather than from the atomic or from the individual end, like a proper physicist should. But anyway. So what happens is when you have a very concentrated bunch of bacteria, as you saw in the bacteria are rod shaped, if you pack a bunch of rods into a container, the rods tend to align with one another in big domains, and maybe there's another domain which is aligned differently. But in the liquid crystal, which is basically made up of rod shaped molecules, the domains are not polar, and reasons for that, as discussed in the book by Duchenne, which I don't want to talk about. But what happens in the bacteria is that you get tremendous collective velocities, collective motion. And that's why it's called a zooming bio-pneumatic liquid crystals. Okay, so they move around, we call it a zooming bio-pneumatic. Anyway, so let's take a look. And so the question is, it's fun to study, that's for sure. The significance is that swimming around stirs the medium. There's a lot of flow through the bacterial colony, through the bacterial population, which is called quorum behavior or majority behavior. They can perhaps chemically signal to one another quite effectively. They have quorum polarity, that is, if you have a bunch of them that line up, then everybody lines up in the same direction. And they zoom around, as you see, and they also produce polymers into the fluid, which they, when the culture gets older, can start sticking to each other, they can stick to the surface, they can create biofilms and so on. So it's a very interesting system. And it's interesting physics even, it's interesting from the biology point of view. So what are the actual phenomena? As I said before, I'll go from the high concentration to the low. Now, this is a picture of a very concentrated bunch of bacteria. And what this is an air bubble. So think of an air bubble in a fluid, okay? And the bubble sits on here. This is where the bubble starts, where there's a little liquid. This is there, so just a feather edge of liquid. There's a monolayer of bacteria here, and it gets deeper and deeper and deeper. So that's one way of taking a look at this. And you see, you get really, this stopping and stopping is really. So you see, you get these remarkably large plumes of coherent regions.
John, is this movie from 1985?
No, I have a timestamp machine which is old, and I can't set it to 005, so this is from 05, all right? I'm used to working things on a shoestring. After Ray Goldstein got there, things got very fancy, but I don't see any reason why I should give up my whole time stamp. At any rate, but you will see a couple of movies from 1997. Those are real.
Why do you have the air bubble?
Because I want it.
Oh.
Okay? Because the air bubble is there in order to see this very well, A, and B, the cells are aerobic, they're obligate aerobic. If they don't have oxygen, then they don't die necessarily, but they stop swimming. And so having an air bubble around is quite good. And one of the ways of doing things is you have a drop that's hanging, you have a sessile drop that you look at the bottom of it. The PID pictures I'll show are like that. Or you could have a drop which is on plastic petri dishes are permeable to oxygen, even the solid part, people don't necessarily know this. So they can swim on the bottom of the petri dish and not, and in the middle be pretty dead. And so anyway, that's why we have a little bit. So here's another one. This is now a deeper layer. Okay. And that big black blob is going around, this is just something happened, a piece of dirt that's betraying on it. There are actually some tracer particles, but you don't see it too well. So we'll take another look at that. You see, you get these very large coherent regions all going in various directions. Now, this looks quite separate. It's chaotic, it's intermittent, it does all kinds of things. And one of the things I'd like to have you think about while you were not falling asleep is how can you have turbulence? This is all very low Reynolds number. How can you have turbulence at very low Reynolds number or quasi turbulence?
Is there a strong three dimensional component of that motion?
Yes. And how can you tell? You can tell by the fact that if you've got a big blob of stuff, it's doing this kind of thing. Okay? So.
Do you have any way to image that? Or?
Not at this point. Yes.
Well, you seem to be having a number of bacteria that are parallel with each other.
Yes.
And it's like a minimum energy state where they're reducing drag by lining up. And
yes.
The unit can essentially move with reduced drag for the unit compared to each individual.
This is very nice if you're running a metropolitan transit company, but why would they want to do that? I mean, why would they want to minimize drag? They might want to maximize the throughput or fluid stirring, or they might want to do some other kind of thing. So you're entirely correct, and the proof of that you're correct is that when they swim together in a bunch, I like to call it a phalanx rather than a swarm. The reason for that is that there are swarming bacteria which change their morphology, and these guys don't. So it's like a platoon or a phalanx. When the phalanx swims, they often swim faster than individual cells can swim. So that suggests that what you said is exactly right, okay? That there is lower drag. And in fact, if you take 10,000 bacteria, you put them all into a sphere of appropriate size, and you have only the ones on the outside pushing with the usual force, that sphere swims faster than individual cells could swim because of the R-squared dependence.
But I would take issue with your asking the question, why would they want to, because that's a teleological question.
No, you asked the question. I didn't ask the question.
Well, when you said, you asked me,
yeah,
why would they want to,
yeah,
reduce the drag, and I think that may be more difficult to answer. I think we have to establish that, in fact, they're reducing the drag, and then we can go on to what that contributes to it in terms of the whole colony either growing or doing something else. But
okay, I'd like to go on the record saying that I don't think they give a damn about the drive. I don't think they do. But I think that if one is an engineer or if one, in Flinton kind, one certainly thinks of that sort of thing right away, as you just did, which is fine. But I don't think that's really it. I think that there's what I was going to perhaps talk to. I was thought it would take too long. I was going to tell in this meeting about my problem of deciding whether things are biology or whether they are physics. And I never know whether it's really biology or physics. And I tend, being who I am, I tend to think of it as physics. But I think in some cases it's biology. And in this togetherness, this quorum sensing, there could be signaling saying let's all swim in the same direction. Or it could be hydrodynamics saying that we have to swim in that same direction because we have no choice. And in fact, what happens, and I'll have a little bit of that at the end of the talk, which is fast approaching. If a cell swims in this direction and hits a wall, it can either do this, and I have a movie of that, or it can actually flip the flagella and swim backwards. And so I think that this, what I call flippancy, the flagella is an important aspect of the quorum polarity. Anyway, I need to go on. Okay, is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is kind of fun. I guess Andrea isn't here. I thought she wanted to see this bacteria to respond to. So this is a few bacteria in a small drop. You see here these are interference fringes, and the bacteria are about 0.7 microns in diameter, as you can measure from the interference fringes or whatnot. So they interact with one another and interact with the fluid. So they swim with the fluid. You think they put out fluid. When you swim, you put out fluid backwards, when you swim forwards, but of course they also drive the fluid forwards, and so it's not a very simple problem. This is a thin layer. You see, by the way, what I'm doing is I'm going from the very condensed, highly concentrated phase to individual cells. Okay, so that's the meaning or the reason for arranging pictures in this way. So this is a very thin layer. The water air plastic triple line is right here. One can actually see quite well. The interference fringes, which don't show up too well on the screen. And the little spheres are 2 micron passive markers, and you see they get driven around beautifully by the swimming cells. So there's a lot of flow. And what you can see also is there are many cells that swim together. So once you have a pair or a multiplet, they tend to swim parallel to one another. And there's a good hydrodynamic reason for that, as I will show you.
How thick is this layer?
This layer is very thin. Up to here, where the cells are stuck, this thickness right here is 0.7 microns.
The depth. How thick is it? That's the depth.
0.7 microns. Okay, up to here, and as you go in, it gets thicker. I don't know because the fringes quit. I'm not quite sure how thick it got, but I have pictures at the end of the show if I ever get there. Which shows swimming with fringes all the way in.
So are some of these beads attached to the bottom?
The ones that are not moving are attached to the bottom. Yeah. I mean, when attached, like this guy, it's just stuck. But the thing that I find particularly interesting is the swimming together. Okay, so now this is a single cell in a single drop with an 8-micron sphere here. You'll see when this guy swims, he will. And he, by the way, he can't get any closer to this because this is about 0.7 micron. But when he hits the brick wall over here, he flips the flagella, sinks backward, and then over here it turns around. So take a look at this. What he did is he, when he started, I'll show you again. He went and he swam and hit the wall. So he hit the wall and then swam backwards, and when he got to the other thing, he turned around and swam a little bit. So let's just do it once more. It doesn't make much sense. Okay, he's approaching, swimming backwards, turning around. So we have a paper in the Fitzgerald Letters. which is a long paper on with good statistics on the swimming reversals. It turns out that when they reverse, they swim back in the back direction as fast as they swim in the front direction. So there isn't a back or the front. When you have peritrichously, that is all over the place, flagellated bacteria, the bundle can go this way, the bundle can go that way, and it's a very interesting. Okay, so now we get a little bit more quantitative. This is a pendant drop, one that hangs. And we have, this is work that Luis Cisneros did. We have fluorescent spheres, fluorescent markers. The markers are, I think, half a micron in diameter. And the markers, this is a little bit slower than real time. The markers are moving around because they're embedded in the flow of the moving bacteria in the fluid. What we have not done yet, but what we will do, and which is in the works, is to have bigger markers which will only go with the bacteria, and real small markers which will go only with the fluid. And these are kind of in between markers. So this is the PIV velocity picture. I'm kind of running out of time, and so I need to go through this very quickly. Okay, and this is a vorticity picture. Yeah. So blue is one way, red is the other way. The error bars are around an average of the spatial correlation functions. And the green things, these red, green, and blue, are individual shots of the correlation function. So the average has correlation of about 0.1 or 0.2, but the individual correlation functions are much more exciting. This is a temporal correlation velocity, a similar kind of a thing. So you see sometimes you get correlations which are very long in some parts of the culture, and sometimes it's not very long. This is vorticity spatial correlation, and this is the vorticity time correlation. Velocity distributions in normalized units are like that. The velocity tends to be on the order of up to several hundred microns per second. The cells swing on the order of 30 microns per second. Most of the time, the velocity of the entrained beads are not on the order of just a little bit faster than the cells swing. So this is the angle. This is the Maxwell, typical Maxwell distribution of velocities. It has nothing to do with Maxwell, but that's what it does. And these are velocity distributions. This is the vorticity distribution. I thought it would be interesting because a lot of the field of view has zero vorticity, that it would be good to get rid of this, to look at if there's any asymmetry. And at the moment, we don't see any asymmetry, but we're going to try and do this a different way, looking at the area of vorticity spots, and I think it's going to turn out to be asymmetric. There's a lot of work, I shouldn't say a lot, there's a bit of work in the literature implying that there should be asymmetry in the directionality, in the rotational directionality of how this cell swings. So now, how can you get turbulence at low Reynolds number? So again, this is an equation like I had before. This is basically the dissipation due to energy density and the dissipation due to shear. And if the Reynolds number is very small, then you have a situation where you have Stokes flow and all the things that go with Stokes flow is large, and you have the ingredients for possibly the turbulence. But the fact is that the Reynolds number is small, and you get turbulent-looking things anyway. So what we let me go back. What we want to look at is here's the Navier-Stokes equation, and what it is the usual things, and there's a body force here. So this body force can be supplied by whatever is entrained in the fluid or lives in the fluid. So for bioconvection, the body force is a net. This is concentration of thingies, and this is the volume. So this is volume fraction, delta rho, and g. That's the body force for bioconvection. For remotely forced sphere, as in sedimentation, it's that. But for a self-propelled swimmer, I think of it as two, as being basically a Stokes drag on the sphere, and then you have the head pushing one way and the tail pushing the other way. And what happens is that if the heads, the forces have to be equal, but the forces don't have to, but that does not mean that the thing can't swim, and I'll show you that in a minute. I'm not doing well in the time at all. So what I'm looking at now is the energy or the forces that you put in with the swimmers, that is the magnitude of the swimmers, divided by the shear, and what I get is that this is a rather large number. So that means that if you have a certain geometry in which is set up by the swimmers themselves, that they will keep it going. So if you have a vortex, they'll keep it going by swimming, because the BS number, please note the name, which stands for bacterial shear, or whatever else you like, is large. So this is why it is that you can get stuff that looks like kind of thing. So even though the Reynolds number is very small, you can still get that kind of stuff. Now notice that the BS number, better than this, the BS number, everything cancels with the viscosity cancels out, everything cancels out, and the BS number is simply a concentration of cells times a cell dimension and a dimension squared of where they are of the typical length scale. So it's a purely geometrical thing, which is very different from other kinds of fluid dynamical numbers. Okay, so oxygen consumption is good. I'm not going to go into that. Whoops. Okay, now. So what I said, I'd like to have a couple more minutes. Is that
sure?
Okay?
Sure. Yeah, because we asked a lot of questions. So
well, not only that, but anyway, so if you have a simplified organism which has a body and a tail, the tail is like a propeller, and the body is like the thing that pushes. Then it can swim. If the tail is actually a helix, you don't have to worry about it being retracted. It can just in Stokes flow, you can do one virtual movement, and you get the whole flow field. So you get the whole flow field by just doing this. And then you don't have to worry about the tail being retracted again, so you can do it once more because it really repelled it. So, and if this is gibberish, I'll tell you again in a minute. So, what happens is that if you have a self-propelled swimmer, the stick is attached to the sphere, the stick is moved backwards, and if the net drag, some resistance coefficient on the front, is equal to the resistance coefficient on the back, the forces are equal and opposite. The back is pushed out with a speed W1 out of here. The front swims with V1, so the net force with respect to the water is V2, is W minus V1, and what you get from that is, whoops, what you get from that, I think I lost this one. What you get from that is net swimming, okay? So this is what happens now. The calculation that Ricardo did by immersed boundary method, you have this thing is going this way, this thing is going that way, and the velocities of the two are not the same because they're equal force but the different sizes, and you have an inward flow and an inward flow and an outward flow and an outward flow. And the reason for that is that this one pushes the fluid this way, this one pushes the fluid this way, and because of incompressibility, you have to supply that flow. You have to supply the lack of fluid into the middle. And this flow actually then produces an attractive force between the organism and other organisms, or between the organism and a nearby surface. So these are the flows. Instead of two spheres, we have an organism and a stick. And this is, this was seen from the top next to a plane, and this is next to a plane from the bottom. And indeed, the organisms, when they are near a plane, they do not swim in 3D, they tend to stay attached to the plane, and they also swim once they're next to one another, they swim along next to one another. Yes, with the spheres. If you have two of them, we have an inward flow. These are the attaching flow, and one can calculate a slight small force between them. And if you have many of them, you get really fancy flows, and this is a situation where everything is still planar, but and not deep enough. So we don't know yet what the flow, what the throughput is through a really good condensed situation.
Sorry, but where you showed the force that's causing them to attract each other,
yes,
along, is there a minimum so that there is a wavelength selection, or do they want to actually be in contact?
I don't really know how to answer that, but except by guessing. And my guessing is that it's completely steering, that it's a contact problem.
Because in the pictures we showed, they swim parallel,
yes,
but they seem to keep.
I understand what you're saying, but I think that one of the situations is that if you think of this as a bacterial cell that has flagella coming out every which way, there's a kind of a halo of flagella around them, and I've looked at them, and I think it may be that halo of flagella that does it. The way the flagella work is, there's a motor here, they come out, and then there's a hook, and they come around, and then they go down. So I think that may be due to this, but I'm not sure. That may be totally wrong. I don't know. One of the things, you know, considering the wonderful stuff I've heard in this conference, one of the things I haven't considered is whether these bacteria are charged. They could very well be slightly charged. They probably are, and there could be some charge repulsion between them.
Have you tried putting, changing the ionic concentration?
I haven't done that, but I should do it. And I mean, we've used different growth media, and we know that there are different behaviors and different growth rates and whatnot, but I haven't done that in an organized way. But after having been here for a few days, by golly, I'm going to do it.
That will affect the contraction of the delta motor. So you have to be very careful. You can't just change the ions haphazardly.
Yeah, that's right. The motors work, by the way, just for people who don't know, the motors work on either protons flowing through the system or sodium flowing through the system. Sodium ions are hydrogen ions. This is I thought that Andrea would enjoy that. This is small drops of bacteria going around and around. switch, which happens in real life, but anyway, I don't know what the answer to this is. I think the chairman is getting upset with me.
No, no, fine.
Okay, so
you can give up a little bit of food for mental sustenance.
So this is swimming in another thin drop. This is the I don't know whether you can see the interference fringes. So in this particular drop, you can really see how deep the thing is going by outside. And this is quite nice. So this is the picture that was done in 97. And you see they swim against one another. It's like a Los Angeles freeway, but without a separating divider. And so we have all this. Oh, this is really quite nice. This is. That's the end. That's the end. So this is published in PhysRev Level. This is a bacterial cell coming in, and it's coming in to where a sphere hits the bottom of the petri dish. It comes in. So this is number 8, and then it hits it, sits there for a while, and then just spins backwards. So we can identify the reversal very nicely. That's the geometry, and this is another movie, and this is